Hello and welcome. My name is Robert Bruce and I'm a financial journalist. This is the latest regular update from the meetings of the IFRS Interpretations Committee. Here to discuss the highlights of the July meeting are its chairman, Bob Garnett, and Michael Stewart, Director of Implementation Activities. Michael, first, you were dealing with the accounting for production stripping costs in the surface mine.
Yes.
Kind of rather more technical. A rather more technical title in reality.
Indeed. Yes, this is a topic that we've been looking at for a little while now, and the Interpretations Committee was really drawing their discussions to a close at this latest meeting. This issue is all about how to account for waste removal costs in surface mining, and in particular looking at those activities, waste removal activities, where there's a significant amount of effort required to what they call it, do a pushback, to broaden a pit or to excavate a new satellite pit connected with a mine, and where the significant amount of effort will be, the benefits of that will be reaped in future periods, and therefore the issue is, well, should those costs be recognised as an asset on the balance sheet, rather than simply expensed in the period in which those costs are incurred. And so the committee has been working on a draft interpretation that will propose that the costs associated with a significant stripping campaign should be accumulated and then amortised over the period over which the specific section of the ore base that those costs will enable you to gain access to will be mined. And one of the key issues there was to try and distinguish the stripping campaign from the sort of routine stripping that a mining company might typically do in other circumstances. So the committee's discussions focused on how to make that distinction, and they've developed a definition of a stripping campaign to help with that. As I say, the committee's discussions have essentially come to a close on that now, and they've decided to propose to the IASB that a draft interpretation is issued. This will go to the board over the next few weeks with a request that is then issued with a 90-day comment period, so published in August, so through to November for comments to be sent in on that.
And you're giving them a good long time to...
Well, yes. I mean, we're coming into holiday season, of course, so a little bit of extra time there. But also that the nature of the issue is quite specialised, so we do want people to have sufficient time to be able to study it and consider what their responses should be.
Good. Another issue you were discussing at the last meeting is the whole business of share-based payments, vesting and non-vesting. Well, what have you decided? How have you progressed?
Robert, I would like to say we've decided, but we haven't quite reached that position at the moment. We're still analysing. It's one of these awkward areas because of the difference in the accounting that arises as to whether things are going to be measured at the grant date or whether they're going to be trued up over time. It puts a lot of pressure on distinguishing just which category the items are going to fall into. So if I put it into technical terms, what we've been asked to look at is to distinguish between a performance condition and other vesting conditions or service conditions, and also particularly where there are multiple conditions, how they interact together and which one perhaps is the dominant one, which one should determine what the accounting should be. So we have tentatively come to some conclusions, but we still have a little bit more work to do. So, for example, we've decided that as most of the pressure is around deciding what is a performance condition and whether the performance actually can be the performance of, for example, the company's share price, a commodity price index or something that is external, or if it has to be based on something that the employee or the company itself does. And we think, actually, a performance condition should be established by reference to the operation or the activities of the entity at large. So not just an individual, but the entity as a whole. But then equally, that is not some external factor like a company share price. Two of the issues that have always been concerning people are what happens if there is a condition in a share award, for example, that says that you will be awarded shares in the event that the company has an initial public offering. And is that a performance condition or is it what we call a non-vesting condition? And it does make a difference to the accounting. And so we think we need to clarify that this IPO type of condition is in fact to be treated as a performance condition. It's something that is a benefit for the entity itself, not an external factor. And similarly, if there's going to be a change of control in the company and shares vest on a change in control, that should also be treated as a performance condition. It would be nice if that's the only question we were asked, so we do have some more work to do, particularly, shall we say, where the performance measure itself goes beyond the required service period, the length of time that an employee is supposed to work. Sometimes you can only determine if the employee's work has resulted in a benefit to the company by going on an extra year or two.
Yes.
So I don't think I need to remind you that these days of the banks and the clawback provisions that are coming through, this is a fairly topical issue.
Exactly. Thank you for that. Can we turn to another issue? The issue of accounting for put options written over non-controlling interests. Bob again.
Yeah, I'm happy to take this one. Put options over non-controlling interests have suddenly hit the interpretation's headlines, as it were, because of the effective date of the revised IFRS 3 and a much greater focus not only on the new business combination accounting, but also changes that were made in IAS 27 dealing with consolidations and particularly the treatment of transactions between the controlling shareholders and the non-controlling interests when we said that they should be accounted for through equity. And immediately this has brought out a conflict. The financial instrument zealots, of course, claim that IAS 39 has supremacy and a put written on, or put that's written that's held by non-controlling interests should be accounted for as a financial liability. And, of course, there are the other zealots in the business combinations camp who claim that it should be accounted for as transfers through equity. So the white knight that's coming to the rescue here is the Interpretations Committee again, and we're trying to clarify and deliberate, in fact, not just in business combination situations, but for all types of puts held by minorities, if we can give some clarity over how to account for it. We think, tentatively, that the right way to account for this is as a liability. Of course, the measurement of the liability and or reflecting the changes in that measurement are key things. But if it is a liability, then we think that changes in that liability should go through profit and loss. But we are aware that not everybody would agree with that view, so we're doing a little bit more research at the moment to try and find a, shall we say, a more palatable way of explaining this. And in particular, there's some concern that if we take a very literal and rigid view of how to account for this liability and the change, we might actually be counting for the bad news twice. So we want to make sure we avoid that double counting issue. So hopefully this will come back to the next meeting of the committee and we can start to move towards a resolution.
Excellent. Another issue you were discussing was amending the hardwired dates in IFRS 1.
Yes, that's right.
Michael.
Now, IFRS 1, of course, is the first-time adoption standard, and in it has a number of exceptions and exemptions from the sort of full retrospective application of IFRSs when a company first adopts IFRS. And a couple of those, both of them relating to financial instruments, have in them an exception. But that exception makes reference to a particular fixed date. In this case, it's the 1st of January 2004. Now, these two exceptions, one is in relation to derecognitions. So this is where perhaps a company has entered into an arrangement, perhaps with their bank, in order to derecognize and remove from their balance sheet some financial assets, for example. And there are particular rules within IFRS that you have to comply with in order to qualify for that off-balance sheet accounting. Now, if you were to do full retrospective application of IFRS, then that would mean going back many years into the past to look at the conditions relevant to those transactions to work out whether you did qualify for that particular accounting or not. The derecognition exemption, when it was first introduced in IFRS 1, when IFRS 1 first came out, allowed you to only have to go back as far as January 2004, which, given that that was about the time that a lot of companies in Europe certainly were transitioning to IFRS, that meant they didn't have to go back very far into the past. Now, here we are in 2010, and January 2004 is quite a long way in the past. So a company that is transitioning today would need to go back to all of its derecognition transactions since that date to then analyse them against the current set of standards to see whether they qualify for the derecognition accounting. We've had a number of requests from entities that are transitioning over the next couple of years, asking us to look at that and to really determine, does that make sense? To if this is supposed to be some relief from full retrospective application, how much relief is it really giving if we're having to go back so far? Now, the Interpretations Committee has looked at this a couple of meetings now and has decided at this meeting to recommend to the Board that they amend the standard so that instead of having this fixed date of 1st of January 2004, that we replace that with the date of transition to IFRS. So that'll be the beginning of the first period presented by an entity in its first IFRS financial statements, which is consistent with some of the other exemptions and exceptions that are within IFRS 1. And the committee's recommendations relate to this exception, but also to another one that relates to measuring financial instruments at their fair value at the date of transition versus the 1st of January 2004. So these recommendations will go forward to the board at the next board meeting, so in a couple of weeks' time. And the recommendation is that the board should make this change and that it should make this change as a separate mini-amendment to IFRS 1 so that it can be progressed as quickly as possible rather than on the sort of slightly longer time frame that an annual improvement, for example, would take. The idea here is that hopefully it would be able to be take effect soon enough for countries that are going to transition to IFRSs over the next couple of years to be able to take advantage of this. Two countries in particular that come to mind would be Korea and Canada that are coming up. So at the moment, that's the recommendation of the committee to the board, and it's now for the board to determine whether that's the right thing to do. If they agree with the committee, then an exposure draft will be published for public comment, and then following that, the amendment to the standard.
And when would you expect the decision from the board? You'd expect it this coming meeting? Or?
That's right, yep. Yes. So the upcoming July 2010 board meeting, we would hope to get a decision from the board.
Good. Another issue, the famous Zimbabwe question. Reporting in accordance with IFRSs after a period of chronic hyperinflation. Bob, what's the answer?
It sounds like we're talking about something like gastroenteritis. And for anybody who's lived through a dysfunctional economic environment, that's probably how they did feel as well. But happily, things seem to be improving in that part of the world. We've had questions raised as to how can they continue to use IFRS as their reporting base, particularly when what they've been going through before means they've been unable to comply with our own standard on hyperinflation, IS29, because there is no price index that they can use to index the base numbers. We've called it chronic hyperinflation to try and distinguish it from just hyperinflation, although that may not be the right term. Because in addition to that, the Zimbabwe dollar was just not exchangeable with any other currency. So they used a combination of hard currency, different foreign currencies, US dollar, euro, South African rand, and also bartering goods, commodities, and in fact services to eke out a living. Quite a challenge to produce any sort of financial statements on that basis. We wondered if In fact, Michael's favourite standard, iForest 1, would have been a useful starting point for them. But that does presume that you've got accounting records that you can use as the basis. So we felt, in fact, really a clean sweep was the right way to start in here. We're also, I think, in the position now where we can go along to the board and recommend to them that they make a change to the standard IS-29 to deal with this specific set of circumstances and say that for an entity that's had chronic hyperinflation, when it comes out of it, when it has a currency, a functional currency that it can actually operate in that is exchangeable, hopefully not a hyperinflationary one, but something a little bit firmer and stronger, what they should do is start off by looking at the assets and liabilities that they've got and measure them at fair value. Now, I can immediately hear people from around the world it's sort of screaming in horror that the ISB's secret plot has now come to fruition and is being wreaked to create great havoc in Zimbabwe. Mm. But in fact, fair value, whilst it may be an esoteric concept to some, is actually the practical way that people have been operating for many years. Mm-hmm. So there will be some issues, there will be some practical matters that the local business people will have to deal with, but generally using fair value as a starting point for the assets and liabilities seems to be the right place. Mm-hmm. And we thought to try and add some structure and comparability with our standards that using the business combinations type approach would be the right one to start with. So if you buy a subsidiary, then you determine the assets and liabilities on a fair value basis. There are some exceptions in there, of course, for things that are difficult, like deferred income taxes, retirement benefit plans, and one or two other things. And we probably are going to recommend to the board that they make some other exceptions. So, for example, they don't have to look for these intangible assets that wouldn't have been recognised in their previous accounts, things like customer relationship intangibles, other internally generated ones, but they do recognise real intangibles. They do have history, so if they've acquired something, if it would have met that criteria for recognition in their own financial statements before, absent the hyperinflation, then they should bring those in. I suppose in a way that's good news, because it gives them a starting off point. The other important thing, of course, is, well, what do you do about comparative information? I mean, we don't think that they could have complied with IFRS during this chronic hyperinflation anyway, and we wondered whether we should just say, well, don't present anything at all. But rather than be prescriptive like that, we are principle-based, so we don't want to establish that rule. We'll just say that IFRS doesn't require comparative information. You start from the date you come out of chronic hyperinflation, and you go forward on the fair value basis from that date forward. And if the local regulator or others want to see comparative information, well, you can include it, but as it were, draw two dark black lines between the IFRS figures, the real figures, and the other figures. And that will communicate, I think, to everybody what's happening in there. There is a little bit of a barb in the tail here as well, though, because many of these companies, even though they're operating in Zimbabwe, are still subsidiaries of other European, American, South African operations. So the question is, well, what does a parent do when it's got a subsidiary that's coming out of hyperinflation? So we did a fair amount of outreach, I think, to find out what people were doing at the moment. Some could continue to account. They could replicate the figures because, in a way, it was an extension of their own business in Zimbabwe, and they were using hard currency. But many of them said, because of the effects of the hyperinflation, that they effectively didn't control and they deconsolidated the subsidiaries. Well, we've decided that really you should draw a line as well, that the old subsidiary, as it were, will be de-recognised. The new subsidiary should be recognised on the basis that we've set under IS-29. So not as if it's a new acquisition, but the rules are very, very similar. So you'll have carryover from the new fair values into the parent, and if that results in a book gain or loss, then, well, that so be it. Book it. And book it through profit and loss, because that's where we put other things.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Looking forward to the programme ahead and issues coming up and the next meetings. Michael, what have we got in store?
Well, we've got a very interesting issue coming to the next meeting in September, which, by the way, is right at the beginning of September, so 2nd and 3rd of September. And the issue relates to arrangements that you find in some countries where there's a statutory profit-sharing arrangement. So a company is required to distribute a certain amount of its profits to its employees, and In those circumstances, the ones that we've been notified about, the calculation of that profit sharing is based on the taxable profit. So the amount that would also be used, the number that would also be used for calculating the corporation tax for the company, is also used as the basis for this profit sharing. Now, as a result of that, there's differences in timing or temporary differences, if you like, between when certain items get recorded as an income or an expense for tax purposes and when they do for accounting purposes. Now, when it comes to tax accounting, we have deferred tax to take account of those temporary differences. And so the question has come to us, given that we've got these same differences here for this profit sharing, should there be a similar accounting applied to the profit sharing as we apply to tax accounting? So should there be deferred profit sharing accounting? And so that's an issue that the committee will be looking at and considering the similarities between tax accounting and this, and also looking at, well, what other literature do we have that might also be applicable? So we do have IAS 19, which relates to employee benefits, this being a payment to employees in return for their services as employees. Would seem to be one particular standard that we should be looking at as well. So there is some sort of previous gap or national gap guidance already available in certain countries for this, but obviously the question that we'll be looking at is, you know, from an IFRS perspective, what's the right way to go? So that'll be an interesting one to look out for next time.
And the next meeting?
Yes.
That comes up.
Early September, so 2nd and 3rd of September. Obviously, we'll be publishing the papers, the observer notes, mid-August. So anybody who is in the Northern Hemisphere on a holiday has got some holiday reading they can take away with them. And yes, so we'll be pretty busy here in the staff preparing those for publication around about the middle of August for everybody to then prepare for the September meeting.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bob. And finally, the traditional disclaimer. This podcast presents a non-authoritative overview of some of the main topics discussed at the July meeting. The views expressed are those of the individuals in the podcast and are not necessarily those of the IFRS Interpretation Committee. Those of you who wish to go into the official detail should refer to the IFRS website and look out for the IFRIC update. Thank you very much indeed, both of you, and goodbye.